This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is episode 43, recorded on April 7th. Today we're talking about model view controller stuff. We're going to focus a little bit on the model part of model view controller and what it all means and how you should construct them. And joining us today, we have Javier Lozano of LozanoTech.com. He has a very, very good blog out there. So let's get started. Javier, why don't you give us a little bit of your background, just so people know who you are, where you're coming from.
Sure. I'm actually out of the Midwest, out of Des Moines, Iowa. So there's a lot of corn and pigs around me, which I'm not sure if it's a good thing. I've been doing software for about probably 15 plus years now, heavily into the web space, now more into the MVC space after doing some Java back in the day. I know it's kind of sad, but during the day, I work as a product manager for a small company here in Des Moines, trying to do a little bit of coding, a little bit of management, a little bit of everything that gets thrown at me. So a lot of fun things.
So you've been doing some blogging recently about MVC. Have you been using it in a production mode, or are you still just kind of exploring it?
Well, actually, I am using it as a baseline of one of our products that we have. The product line that I'm in charge of is we have both an embedded piece of software that runs on scanners, right? These are scanners that run .NET on top of Windows XP embedded. So we have the problem of we have hundreds of scanners out there in the field. Well, how do we keep track of all of them? Well, what we ended up doing is we ended up developing a server that the scanner will then quote unquote phone home to, and if we need to enable a scanner or change what kind of software is deployed on it and so forth, we needed that server architecture. And at the time when we were actually building the server, at that time I think it was preview three or four of MVC was around that, was coming out around that time, and I said, well, let's build it in MVC and try to actually gain some of the flexibility it gives us out of the box. So we ended up doing that, and right now we have it out in production, managing. Our largest one is about, I want to say, 100 or so diverse scanners out, and it's loaded. This application is loaded on in a cluster farm and so forth, and it's scaling just fine, using in Hibernate in the background, Winter, you know, all those open source tools that makes your life a lot easier. It's bundled onto that product. So I've had the joy of moving from preview to preview to beta to beta to finally RTM. So it's been a huge learning experience of how the flexibility of MVC and how do you actually crank out a real world application. And of course I have a bunch of demos here and there that also work nice, but they don't work as nice as actually a real production application that if it breaks, your customers will not be happy with you.
All right, that's cool. So you're doing real stuff with it. That's good. John?
Well, so you're talking about using an Hibernate as your kind of back-end storage. And so I wonder how are your and Hibernate entities kind of mapping to models directly? Do you have other layers? You know, how smart are your models?
My models are not that smart. And it wasn't because it was a decision because of time. There was a lot of people in my team who didn't understand Hibernate as well, because it was sort of like, here's an ORM tool, let's go use it. That was kind of the approach that they took. So it was a little bit hard for us to say, oh no, let's leverage this feature of in Hibernate, let's leverage this other feature of it to allow us to do more data manipulation at that level. So what we've done is we've taken in Hibernate and the entities just to model the data, right? Model the core, the relationship of what we're trying to accomplish in the real world. And then we've taken all of our quote unquote business logic and shoved it into our services layer or tier or whichever you want to call it. So that layer interacts with those entities and actually can perform whatever operations on it. So if we do change it, we change it in that service and don't have to worry about, again, propagating those that changes throughout. our goal is to kind of split the difference in the logic as putting more of the validation of, is the value, like, for example, if I add a value of 100, is that a correct range value? That kind of logic, push that more to the entity, because since it is modeling more of that real world scenario, as compared to in the service, put more of the orchestration or the communication between different components that we're trying to do. So if it were up to me, that would be V2 of the product. But right now it's looking more like V4 or V5 just because of other things that are coming up around the pipeline. And from there, you know, it allows us to literally unit test and do whatever we need to around those entities and those pieces without having to really repeat ourselves throughout.
So one of the reasons why the model piece of this has certainly come to the forefront in recent days is through a couple of blog posts, one from Rob Connery and a series from our very own K. Scott Allen, just about the model piece of MVC. There's a lot of, you know, people have been talking a lot about, you know, controllers and unit testing controllers and all that stuff. And, you know, the model piece is sort of, seems like it's gotten less discussion. So first one, and I see if K. Scott wants to give sort of a summary of some of the stuff that you're exploring and kind of the stuff that you've been touching on your blog post.
Well, sure. This all came about because I've been really using MVC a lot over the last couple months, and I ran across a blog post a few weeks ago by a developer who had been using Ruby on Rails and just switched to the ASP.NET MVC framework and said, hey, you know, the only thing I get out of the box when I do file new MVC application for the model is just a directory that says models. Models go here. But there's no guidance on how I should create a model or what should go in there. And to me, that's sort of how Microsoft has always operated. They've always given you a framework and they've always given you visual designers. And this is even going back to like the Visual Studio 6 days where you could create an MFC application and drag some controls around on a dialog box. But, you know, there was never really any guidance on how do you access a database or the file system or how do you build domain logic and how do you get data put into your window. And I guess for me, the environment, that's the way it always has been. But then I started taking a look around and saw that people are sort of confused when they look at the MVC framework because there is no guidance there. And the guidance that you do hear is sort of conflicting. And, well, to some extent, not always true. Like, you can go out and hear people say that your views should be stupid, your controller should be skinny, your model should be fat, which would lead most people to think that the model that you actually hand off to your view is a model that also represents your domain logic and validation logic and all this stuff. And sort of what I was exploring in my post was that, yeah, there's a time where you can go in with a tool like nHibernate or Link2SQL or Entity Framework, and you can build a model that's full of entity classes and maybe some validation services or other pieces of your business application. And your controllers can essentially create a new nHibernate session or a Entity Framework object context and bring some entities to life and hand those off to the view. And that's just one way to do things. And I think that's the way that you see things done in samples like nerddinner.com and Rob's MVC templates that work with Subsonic. So in those examples, you always see the controller actions just pulling some entities to life, handing them over to the view. And my point really was that there's another way to think of a model, and that is that the model that's actually being consumed by the view, you can think of it as just a view model. And a view model doesn't need behavior, it doesn't need state, it doesn't need to be smart at all. It really just needs to be a data transfer object that represents exactly what that view needs.
I agree with you. You know, that's one of the biggest things is that when they look at the word and they look at the M and model, you know, like, oh, there's so many ways you can, you know, slice that. And I think you're right. It's more separating, treating the model as a DTO, or, you know, data transfer object towards the view. You can be dogmatic and say, do it for all MVC apps, you know, or you can say, well, you know, if the app gets so much complex, then apply logic or not.
Right. And I certainly said there was a place and time for applications that I call basically forms over data, which is basically you're giving the user a nice user interface to do something that they could do with Enterprise Manager, but they're not going to have SQL Server Enterprise Manager Management Studio installed on their machine. So you're giving them a web UI to just essentially enter data that goes directly into a table with a little bit of validation and simplistic applications. You don't want to overbuild things, but I don't know. To me, there's probably 50% of the applications out there are not like that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So what approach did you guys use, Javier, when you were building your MVC stuff? Did you go for more for the view model approach?
Yeah, we actually went with the view model approach. We took the approach of actually taking out the classes, you know, because out of the MVC project and treating the MVC project just like a web project, like an ASP.NET web forms project, right? So it's just a container for web-related stuff. And the web-related stuff was mostly the views and the controls and all, you know, jQuery and all that stuff that went inside of it. And we took the model and pushed it out into its own assembly. Sorry, that model modeled the entities, the relationships, and so forth. And then we created another assembly that was what I called the dot MVC assembly that contained the controllers, the view models, and all the other extensions and plumbings that allows us to plug in into the MVC framework. So for example, since I was talking about scanners, we have a base class called a device. And the device contains, you know, the SKU, the properties, the day it was shipped, the administrator, and all that information. All of that is modeled as a POCO, as a, you know, plain old CLR object. And what we do is we take a subset of that data, because we may not want to display all of that in a grid, for example. We take a subset of that data and we have the device grid view model, which is just the information that it needs specifically for that grid. And then we have the device detail view model, which has all the information that it needs to, because then at that point we're trying to model, again, the relationship that it contains within it. And if you were to look at our view models as compared to our actual models or POCOs, it's a lot different, and it's just a lot thicker in the view model sense.
So Javier, what's the difference between the presenter model and the view model?
It's just what?
There are some differences, but you know, it's just the provider model branding all over again.
Yeah. I guess it does, since it doesn't come from Fowler, it takes a different approach, I guess. I don't know. I think it's easier to, how can I say, trying to grasp, just because of it is something, it provides a more straightforward understanding of hey, it's a filtered view, right? And it doesn't require any eventing. It's just here, it's dumb, and it's as dumb as it gets. That's the best answer I can come up with, since they're both very similar.
I'll take a crack at that one too. First of all, there's this confusion when you say view model these days, I think, because of the Silverlight and WPF pattern of the day, which is model view, view model. And the view model in that you would use with Silverlight is a little bit smarter than a model that I would hand off to a view in an MVC application if I'm doing the data transfer object type model. And that's only because the commanding that you can set up in WPF and Silverlight for button click events and so forth can actually initiate behavior in the view model. So to me, the view model, when they talk about view models in Silverlight, that's really more like a presentation model. It's a little bit smarter than what I consider a view model, which is just data. There's no behavior. Presentation model is a little bit smarter, has a few more smarts. I mean, it's still ostensibly designed just to shuttle data to the view and put it into a representation that's easy to data bind against, but with the commanding, you have calls back into that view model.
So it's a two-way thing in the richer right. Sort of Silverlight presentation model.
Right, but it's still subtly different than model view presenter, because in model view presenter, the view's delegating work to the presenter also, but in that scenario, it's actually invoking behavior on the view and saying, hey, go do this or go do that.
Part of the reason that the Silverlight view models are you know, calling into anything else is because you don't really have any options there. Whereas with WPF, you can have routed commands that go directly from the view to anywhere. I mean, so, you know, you can properly, you know, communicate with the controller or something, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. But I mean, even the model view model stuff that I've experimented with in WPF, you could still route those commands to your view model and change the model around, and through the magic of data binding, stuff happens in the view then. Is that making any sense?
Yeah, because with data binding, you don't have to be explicit. You can just you know, make things work, whereas in MVC, you really do have to, like, the controller has to render a view for anything to actually happen.
Right, right.
I was talking with Jeremy Miller a little bit on Twitter today about it, and we were just, well, it started off with Sean Wildermuth and saying, you know, the view would own the view model. And I, you know, I said, no, I like the view to be really, you know, dumb. And I don't favor a view that owns anything. I think it should just do what it's told. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led into a presenter, MVVM, yeah, discussion with Jeremy Miller. And I liked the way that he described it. He says MVP denotes a stateful conversation between presenter and view, whereas MVC mm-hmm. is just linear.
Yeah, he's very smart.
Yeah, to me, the view in MVC sort of, if anyone owns the model, to me it's sort of the view, and it's not necessarily that the view does anything but just pull data out of the model, but it's still, when you're designing your view model for that view, what are you going to put into the view model? Well, it's, you know, what are you going to display in the view that sort of defines what goes into that model?
So this notion of the view model is interesting to me because, and let me just preface this comment by saying that I'm a total Rails, you know, newbie, and I've only tinkered with it. I've never done anything real with it. But they don't, from my sort of initial reading, they don't really have this notion, like views sort of interact directly with models.
And, right.
And that, you know, in the Rails world, you know, they don't, this, you know, domain-driven design stuff, it's not really, you know, that common a pattern. I'm curious, do you have an opinion on that? Is there, why is it so big and, you know, on the .NET side and not so much on the Rails side?
Who's the question for?
Anybody.
Oh. Well, my take on that one is that Rails is very convention-oriented and geared towards trying to give you everything that you would need to build an application the Rails way. Whereas if you look at the MVC framework that Microsoft built, it's very much geared towards building any type of application any way you would want it. And you can see that everywhere. You can see that on a micro scale, and you can see that on a macro scale. So at the macro scale, we've already talked about, you get a big empty model folder. So what goes in there? Well, it's up to you. It depends on your application. Some people want to do domain-driven design. Some people just want to use link to SQL classes and be done with it. And on a micro scale, you can also see it in things like the update model and try update model APIs, where during a post operation, you're just trying to get stuff from the form information that's been posted back into an object. And if you look at all the overloads for update model, there's like, I think 10 different overloads for that one method. Some of them you just pass in the model. Some of them you pass in a model and a whitelist and a blacklist. Some of them you pass in a model. You can also have your model inherit from an interface that describes what properties should be set. And in a way, it's a Swiss Army knife. It's great because it can do anything for any type of application. But at the same time, if you just want it to do one thing for your application, or the first time you see the IntelliSense window pop up, you have to look at it and say, what the hell? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, well, actually, even to add to that, to, you know, the whole Rails thing, is that when you do Rails, you know, you have active record as a mode of getting access to your data, right? So, like, it goes back into that convention. With Microsoft, you know, how many ways do we have of getting data out of a database? You know, ADO, link to SQL, Hannity framework, you know, you can name, keep on naming. So it is tailored more into the fact of how can I quickly get an application up and running.
Yeah, there's only one now. It's called RIA Services.
Oh, it's called RIA Services now? And actually move forward with it. And that's one thing that, I, you know, going back to that blog post you were talking about, Scott, with the Rails developer going to MVC, you know, about his rants, some of the rants that he had on to, I completely wholeheartedly agree. The fact that, you know, there's a million ways to get this thing done on MVC as compared to Rails is restrictive because you have to go down this path, which could be a blessing because, you know, prevents you from going down a path that could potentially not map against your application.
Yep.
But again, people want options. It's why we're in the software business, I guess. But, you know, to tie something close to that, I would say something like Monorail. I'm not sure how many guys have played with Monorail, part of the Castle project. You know, what they do is they try to mimic, and they actually do a very good job of mimicking Active Record on top of that, which underneath the covers uses an Hibernate for doing all the mapping from the record that represents your entity against the actual data underneath of it. And if you were to do a plain project out of just using Monorail out of the box, you will have very little friction and things will just work straight out of the box because it's just wired. It's wired up to be that way. And the MVC framework is not, and I'm not saying it should be, it's not, it's more of like, again, it's more of the front controller. Here you go. Do what you want with it.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely trying to reach as wide an audience as possible. So in many ways, people will walk up to Rails and they'll find it very easy to learn and they'll, you know, just right off the bat, things will click. Whereas I'm always kind of afraid with things like MVC adoptance that people will look at it and never be able to figure out which direction they should go in, which is sort of always the case with Microsoft technology. But then, you know, you look at things like the Subsonic MVC project template that Rob put out that just, I mean, it just spits out everything all at once for you.
Well, I kind of like that approach where it's like instead of, you know, just kind of dropping you in the cockpit of the plane and saying, you know, hit some dials, you know, make something work. It's kind of like, you know, put you on the, you know, to pardon the pun, to put you on the rails, you know. And so I like that. And I know that what Rob did was very heavily influenced by his Ruby on Rails work, where, you know, it was kind of like, let's start with something that actually works pretty well. And then if you want to customize it, if you want to tinker with it, then get in, you know, it's a template, write your own template, tweak it, do whatever you'd like, you know. And, you know, in a way, I mean, this, I hadn't heard that comparison before, but, you know, and I'm starting to think about that. If Rhea Services is actually, you know, providing some of that approach for Silverlight too, but that's kind of a separate topic. So
just to continue down a slightly different angle. So one of the obvious sort of downsides to the view model approach is duplication. Seems like you could end up, if you're trying not to pass your models to your views, then you end up creating view models that duplicate all sort of the data of your models. So, you know, how do you avoid that or how do you address that? Anyone jump in?
I can tell you that from my experience, there's really no way to avoid that just because you may need some of the information that it's in your model, you know, to display it on a grid or display it on a text box or whichever. And it does get a little bit hard to managing. It's just the same thing as letting your models go wild, right? You can have every property under the sun and everything. It makes it a little bit harder. One of the things that we did find out that makes it a lot easier is trying to be explicit on your view models. So like I was mentioning earlier, if you're going to be displaying something on a grid, then just have the information that it needs for that grid. And it seems very atomic, but it also prevents you from having a big ripple if you need to add something else, because at that point you're just addressing that one specific context. So, you know, I guess it's, you can say single responsibility principle, you know, on crack, but it has worked well for us since we mostly are not changing some of those view models going forward. But on the other side, we also have, I don't think, about over 150 view models that we have to manage. So six in one, half a dozen in the other.
A lot of these projects, I see someone ultimately sits down and writes an object-to-object mapper. And that's one way to avoid writing that left-to-right property code where you just say this dot this equals that dot that and this dot this equals that dot that. I mean, that's the kind of duplicate code that drives me nuts. It doesn't bother me too much. There's, you know, 100 different view model classes and that someone had to actually define those because they're not anything that really need tested. They're just one property after the other. There's no behavior inside of them. But that is something to consider. I mean, it's definitely something that turns people off when they think about it, about how many classes they'll have to write.
Yeah, and actually, to add to that, Scott, the way we did it is we use extension methods, right? So in our MVC, quote-unquote, assembly, we have the extension methods when the entity can say, you know, my device dot to view model. And that's the standard that we, or convention that we establish, is we always have the that to view model extension method that will then spit out that view model. So then our services are dealing with, they know about the entity from the repository, but again, spit out that view model that they're, that it is expected by the controller to pass down to the view. And I do agree that it does cut the code quite a lot. And then it more, not only that, it puts it all in one spot, so you can address it there.
This seems like an area where a tool like AutoMapper, it's a relatively new open source project from Jimmy Bogart, I believe his name is, you know, can handle a lot of that sort of munginess. You still need to define your view model classes, which is some duplication, but at least you don't have to write the grungy low-level mapping code.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like AutoMapper.
Have you used it on a project yet? I haven't had a chance to.
I have. Nothing that's actually shipping yet, but it's getting there.
See, now I'm going to have to go check it out.
Yeah, I think he just did like the 0.3 release this week or last week.
So I always wonder about these. So, you know, if you're doing something that could be automatically mapped, then is there maybe, you know, is there a better way to do it where it's just done, you know, like what's the advantage of having parallel objects that need to be mapped in that way? Just to keep one lighter than the other?
Again, I think it goes back to the case of your view model is dedicated to a view or a set of views, whereas your entities and domain model or the model that's in your business layer is owned by your business layer. And when you get into these more complicated applications, those two forces, if you're trying to share something between the views and your business layer, those two forces sort of pull from two different sides on that object, and you'll find yourself seeing that, okay, in the view, I need some sort of, average rating for my movie reviews or something. So now where am I going to put that so that right. I can get to it from the view? Whereas the business logic doesn't, you know, want to see that, or it's not going to make any difference down there. And the business logic wants to add other stuff. And, you know, and then you pass these entities up into the view, and someone in the view does employee.department.manager to get the manager, or employee.department.manager.firstname to get the manager's first name in the view. And little do they know, that just created two more SQL queries because you're lazy loading through and Hibernate. Whereas with a view model, you would never have to worry about that. You've brought everything back from the database, packaged it up, handed it over to the view. The person that's writing the view, typically those view models are very flat objects, so they don't have to do anything dot anything to get to the data they need. And you don't have to worry about views creating extra SQL queries or someone calling, you know, employee.terminate in the view and actually invoking a method. It's just a very, very clean separation, and it really isolates the two concerns. But there's a price to pay for it. So just all depends on how complex your application is.
Does that question we had earlier from listener, does that fit in now? I'm not sure if it does.
Oh, Steve Bolin? Yeah, I guess yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, the question was about the relative importance of persistence ignorance in the M part of the MVC triad. How important is it?
If you ask me, I think it's very important because the reason why I say that is because I'm a firm believer of the repository pattern, right? I don't care how data gets persisted. I just care that it does. Because as we talked about, you know, we have RIA services. We may have Link to SQL and Hibernate, Active Record. It doesn't matter. You know, it's just something handles it for me. So it's important that my model doesn't know anything about a way of getting persisted. Like I'm okay with marking it as virtual, like a property or adding a serializable tag on it, attribute, just to allow it to, you know, serialize to memory if I need it or whatever. But beyond that, you know, it's just, you know, keep that concern out of the model. But if you're using something like Active Record, then, you know, yeah, obviously you're going to be more tightly coupled to that persistence of that object.
I liked how you said that, K-Scott, in your series, where it was just kind of like, you know, if you've got a round peg and a round hole, go for it. You know, it's like if you've got,
right,
if your model maps to your view cleanly, then, you know, it's your next step is obvious, you know. But if it doesn't, that's the important thing, is to recognize when you're trying to make something fit and not, and it doesn't work. And I think sometimes the tricky thing is you start with a simple case, you know, you start with somewhere that Active Record fits pretty well, and then pretty soon you've drifted over into a more complex scenario. I was working on an app where it was we were using Subsonic. It was very simple mapping of, you know, it was data entry in forms and grids, and it was awesome, you know. And then pretty soon these new things start creeping in, and we were able to, you know, we could write, you know, Subsonic does have the ability to, you know, you can alter your queries and you can change things and you can alter your, but pretty soon it was not an Active Record scenario at all anymore. And I think, you know, I held on to that too long, you know, I should have recognized earlier, like, hey, we need, you know, we need another layer here. We need to rethink what we're doing because this is not a good fit anymore. Instead, I was, you know, frantically trying to whack the square peg into the round hole.
It all depends on the hammer that you use.
That's right.
Yeah. It's always tough to know exactly when to call Yagni.
Right, right.
Which is, you ain't gonna need it.
I think all of us, like, have different, like, my failing is that I always try to stay with the simple case as long as possible, maybe too long. And then, but I do know also, you know, I've worked with people that immediately jump to the most complex case, and, you know, the whole Yagni alarms go off 24 hours a day because you're constantly, you know, writing controller factories for, you know, one-off web forms, and you know what I mean?
Yeah. Then you need factories for your controller factories.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, see, typically I err on the side of the least amount of code that I get to write. And I found out, like, just using, like, in Hibernate allows me to do that very quickly, and I'm able to not even worry, you know, I don't have to write any SQL at all. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with SQL. I'm just saying that it's one less thing I have to worry about. And using, you know, using it that way, it just makes it easier for me to move forward with what the next problem that I have to deal with, you know, with which might be validation or whatever. And I guess that's my hammer when it comes to trying to get, you know, things quickly and simple out the door.
So someone had a validation question earlier. Were you saying that your validation lives in a service layer somewhere?
Yeah, that is correct. Yep, whenever anything happens is, to kind of lay out the structure, is the request is gets handled by the controller. The controller then knows which services it needs to work with because they get injected, and then it takes that information, which is that data, which is, it's a view model. It hands it to it. It does whatever validation after it hydrates an entity or a model that they may need to work with, and it handles that there. And then persists whatever information it needs to back to the database, or fetches more information, and then returns that information across. And we found out that at least for our case, for what we're trying to do, that works pretty well. It's all concise, it's all specific, and when we have unit tests, and we can just unit test that that specific service, and be able to run whatever changes we want on it. It's not great, but it works.
Cool.
And validation does seem like another potential benefit of, you know, the view model separation, where, you know, the validation of the data coming from the view is not necessarily the same as the validation of the domain model. So you may have a, you know, a date time in the domain model that in the view might be represented as, you know, three edit boxes, and that's going to have a different you know, set of validation requirements than something happening in the model. So, you know, having that nice split there, you know, gives you a sort of a natural way to do sort of contextual validation.
Have any of you guys worked around with the model binder pieces of the MVC framework, or at least heard about them?
Yeah, a little bit.
I've heard about them.
I think, you know, kind of what you were talking about there, Kevin, about how the validation of how the view might represent the data is three different text boxes and so forth. I think that's where something like the model binder can work great, because the model binder can be executed. It's executed before your action is actually being called by the controller. And you have access to both the binding context of the data from the form and also the controller. So like what we do is we actually write our own mapping just to, again, to have more control of the data. So we actually parse the values out of the form out using a model binder and do whatever validation we want in there, making sure that it is correct, that at least it's, you know, input correct, and then generate that view model that gets handed to the controller. And if it doesn't work quite right, then we can add errors to the model state, and then the controller can say, oh, it's an invalid model, you know, things didn't go, don't even bother invoking all this extra logic that's needed, just go ahead and return it back, and then display whatever error messages need to be displayed because of the invalid data. And it works pretty well.
Scott Hanselman has had some posts on model binders recently. I was just reading one where he did a date-time model binder where it had two separate text boxes, one for date, one for time. But then, you know, by the time it gets back to the model, it's composed back into a single date-time.
Yeah. No, and that works great. We actually, and it's not just for single date-times. We're actually using it for files. So one of the aspects of our service is we need to upload a new extension, which is a modularity piece of the server, and we actually have a model binder that will handle the HTTP base posted file. I don't remember the exact name of the class, and we can actually query that there and do whatever we need to on it.
Jimmy Bogard had an interesting post over at Lost Ekis, and hopefully I can find it so we can post it in the show notes. Where he had done something with the model binder. Any of you guys know what I'm talking about? Remember that? Let me see if I can find it here.
Is that his post, a better model binder?
I think that's it, yeah.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, we can definitely put that in the show notes.
See, I wonder if some of that code is inside of the MVC contrib project. Because some of the stuff that those guys are doing in there, it's pretty nice and pretty straightforward when you try to come to convention. Have you guys seen with it or play with it at all?
I haven't. I mean, what's
with the MVC contrib?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's some great things in there.
Yeah, I'm using the Windsor controller factory stuff in there. Very nice. Very handy.
Yeah.
See, we're using AutoFac at the contract I'm at now. I don't know if you guys met David Foley. Okay, Scott, you probably had the opportunity to if you're at Alt.net Seattle. But I'm working with him over there, and he has got MVC over there just humming to the point where we're just writing classes and everything just, you know, magically is auto-registered and works and shows up. The AutoFac guy, I think he started on the MEF team. And we were looking at Jimmy Bogart's smart binder just because we were having to do lots of odd, you know, if this model property is null, because we're on the web forms view engine, and he had suggested it over Twitter, and we haven't used it yet anyway, but it looked like an interesting idea. I haven't done anything with model binders yet, and it's like the one thing in MVC that we haven't really touched.
So what's the idea with the smart binder? It tries to find a matching binder?
Right. And then if it doesn't, puke out.
Oh, okay.
Which is the problem we were having. We were trying to, you know, bind up or we were running into issues where, you know, things would be null when we were trying to touch them. Primarily when we were trying to touch nested properties on our view models. So we'd have, you know, a property that contained an object that then had another property that had a list of things. And if that list was null, then eventually it would puke out and we'd get this NRE that would, you know, bubble up to the yellow screen of death. And this would certainly solve that problem.
Yeah, so John, just to answer your question, the idea with SmartBinder is that it basically has a list of binders and it gives each one an opportunity to say whether or not it can handle the type that's being bound. So it gives them a little, instead of just, you know, statically mapping a particular type to a binder, it can sort of discover them on the fly, which is pretty nice. Wow.
Binder injection.
Yeah, and actually it's a pretty interesting way, because if all the samples that you see for model binders is that you have to define it as an attribute, you know, you apply an attribute to your method, to your action in your controller. And the way, at least, Jimmy's doing it with the smart binder is he's actually replacing the default model binder. So it says, you know what, it tells MVC, you're going to use this one. You know, I don't care whatever else, this is the one you're going to be using out of the box. And it makes it so much easier and less intrusive as an attribute might be on the method.
Shun him, shun the non-believer.
Hey, I have nothing against attributes. I'm just saying that it's an interesting topic when it comes to model binders, because the model binder attribute requires you to put the type. So if you actually looked at it, you have to say model binder, then you have to say type of whatever type you're going to be specifying there. And it seems there's a lot of ceremony around that. And it takes away from just looking at the variable of your model, of your view model that's going to be placed in there. So I recommend something more like the smart binder replacing it, or doing more of the specific registration of the binder and the application start.
I'm just trying to think of why. I mean, some of it's maybe style, but I'm wondering if there's performance benefits to using an attribute where it's compiled, you know, at application compile time versus having to do a discovery at runtime to look up a binder.
No.
All right, I have my answer.
Shun him.
Any kind of, if there is any performance benefit, and I've never tried to profile attributes versus looking up, I think they would be far overwhelmed by the misuse of attributes.
Just from a maintainability standpoint, I'd rather have everything configured through a IOC container or, you know, something that's registered in global.asax, and, you know, have to go through and change 50 attributes on 50 different action methods.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like what can happen. But.
Yeah. So on the attribute front, one of the, I posted a couple of MVC tips, and one of my tips was to use a separate error view for specific exceptions that you know might be thrown, rather than, and I kind of said that instead of using the handle error attribute on methods. Ben Sherman and a couple other people had chimed in and said that's an excellent way to reuse code, the handle error attribute, excellent way to reuse code across controllers and classes. So I was going to see what you guys thought about that.
I don't have any errors in my code, so I wouldn't know. No, I'm kidding. I do that a lot. I reuse the handle error attribute mostly at the action level than I do at the class level, at the controller level, and allows me to not only just reuse the same handle logic, but also I may want to display the same error message or the same view for that specific logic. So again, it just allows me to just kind of put it there and lets something else handle that for me.
So maybe we should kind of distinguish between attributes as metadata versus attributes as markers. So so like something like serializable isn't as big a sin as, you know, bind to this, you know, model property.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I don't know where that was going. It sounded smart when I thought it said it in my head, though.
No, actually, I think that does kind of... In one case, you're saying this is an attribute... I think in a way, when you're doing bindings or you're setting specific... when you're doing wire-up in an attribute, it's kind of a misuse of what an attribute was originally designed for, kind of.
Yeah, where I thought you were going with that was attributes as metadata are good. Attributes that actually introduce behavior into my application, maybe not so good. So like action filters that actually, you know, can hook pre-action executing and post-action executing and actually change the flow of logic or throw exceptions and things like that. That's not what you expect an attribute to be able to do.
See, that's what I was trying to say, and I said it all wrong. I meant metadata terms influencing things, but doggone it.
I think that's one of the many things that Chad and Jeremy did with FUBU was, well, for one, our whole discussion of model, they firmly believe in having a view model, and there's only one view model that goes up to from the controller to the view, and there's only one view model that comes into the controller. But I think they also completely did away with the concept of action filters, and they have behavior classes that they can layer in for pre- and post-processing instead of attributes.
Yeah,
but we know you like them.
I totally agree. I tweeted a little rant about this a while back that I think it was the WCF team that first did this, where they introduced actual like logic into their attribute classes.
Which team?
The WCF team.
Oh yeah.
The behavior stuff. It just seems like a kind of a perversion of what the original intent of attributes are, and it really can be a pain if you want to use IOC because you have no control over the life cycle of your attributes. Like, you don't get a chance to hook their creation, really.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you're stuck doing something like a service locator. And so, you know, I do not like that approach for, you know, sort of injecting behavior into your classes.
Well, it almost seems like that like you're saying, that you should be able to do that. Like, if attributes were overridable, or if there was a way that, you know, that the attributes were part of a configuration system, like, so you could inject, because this seems to come up on just about everything, you know. I mean, discussions about RIA services, discussions about any kind of, like, framework, and then it's like, well, where do you configure it, and where do you map it, and where do you wire it up? And it's like, it'd be cool if you didn't have to choose. Like, you know, you could say, okay, here's this, but if you don't like it, configure it here, inject it here. It just seems like we solve the same problem, or we argue about the same problem for every single framework that comes out. It's like, is it attributes? Is it injectable? Is it configuration? Is it whatever? You know, it'd be nice if the answer was yes.
So what view engine are you happy with, Javier?
I'm actually, right now, I'm happy with the view web forms engine. Not because it is the best engine. It is because it kind of helps kind of bridge the gap. I have a developer who is a ColdFusion developer who has seen a bit of ASP.NET web forms. And so I'm using that as kind of like, as the Rosetta Stone per se to try to bring the two worlds together. And we have another developer who is who has done some web forms. So again, it serves that way. If it were up to me, I would use either Spark or Envelocity because it's very lightweight. And I don't have to deal with all the extra stuff that the WebForms view engine gives me.
Scott Kuhn's about to ask you about jQuery.
Uh-oh.
Whoa, I am.
See, I knew.
No, not directly.
Oh, bummer.
So we're using WebForms, the WebForms view engine as well, and one of the things we're running into is that we just can't find any way to test our views. But, you know, so we're running into these things where the MVC framework tries to be just dynamic enough to make things easy. But if you do things like change the definition or the view model that's getting passed down out from under the view engine. There's no way for it to tell. And so you just get the type runtime error. You know, it's expected this, but got this. And things like that. So one of the things we've been looking at and trying to evangelize with our team is that MVC is not just for the server, it's also for the client. So we're almost turning our controllers and views into not necessarily web services, but like zero latency web service calls, kind of, on initial load, and they'll just emit down JSON. And then we use JavaScript to dynamically create our templates. Or at least we're trying to. In some cases, it makes sense. Rather than, you know, of course, doing back a full post back for, you know, changes in certain parts of the UI, especially in our search area. Previously, we were returning big hunks of HTML down, partial views. And so we're trying to move away from that and go back to kind of the separation of concerns and the reason that we picked MVC in the first place. That would be awesome.
Hey, I got a question for you in regards to that, because I was looking into ext.js originally when we were first kind of spiking this product I was working on with MVC. And I like the fact that, again, you know, I had JavaScript because it allowed me to do more stuff with it. What are you guys rolling your own, or are you using something, you know, just jQuery with all the extensions, or what kind of take are you taking with that?
We're using jQuery. I think most of the free world is, but in my opinion, it starts to fall down when you need to write things like controller logic or maybe some model or service logic, because jQuery is really designed to just manipulate DOM elements. And, you know, if you're doing MVC on the client, you tend to need to write some kind of logic in there, and jQuery kind of doesn't help much. You just kind of write your own.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm using a little bit of jQuery, but not as much as extent as I wanted to, again.
Ext.js is really good if you need a lot of UI widgets, and it does a lot of the data. If I'm remembering correctly, it's got a lot of helper methods and objects that deal with the data a lot better, like data sets, things like that. It's a way you can build Web 2.0 applications without using Web 1.0 controls. And it is compatible with jQuery and Prototype. Are we going to get sued?
I don't know if that's like a trademark.
Yeah, we tease Scott Hanselman, but he could sit back with his 20,000 followers and 150,000 readers and his big fat principal program manager. I don't even know what the hell a principal project manager is at Microsoft. I think they made it up just because they didn't want to say Chief Scott. It's that title's already taken by Scott.
The other Scott.
Right. Yeah, that's what his title is, the other Scott. The goo and the other Scott.
All right, have we exhausted this topic?
I don't know, we're exhausted. We're getting punchy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was trying to think up some questions for a lightning round, because we haven't had one in a while. We keep talking about it.
Oh, that's, yeah,
true.
I have three of them down. Maybe if we just kibitz a little longer, I can get a couple more. If I can get five here in the next, if I can get two more in the next 30 seconds, then I'll do one. In the meantime, maybe you could tell us what the best fried food is in Iowa.
Best fried food, huh? That's interesting. Well, if you're talking about like the Iowa State Fair, you talk about the Twinkies, the Snickers.
No, food. You said food.
You fry a Twinkie long enough, it becomes food.
That's right. If you put enough batter in it and just shove it in there, it comes out pretty good. There's not much of fried food in Iowa. It's more of the pork chops, steaks. You know, there's plenty of that around going, you know, in a farm. So might as well just take advantage of it, right? I do have something to plug though, if I could.
Plug away.
Eric Hexter and I, Eric is a really big into the MVC Contrib project, and also has other great projects out of Codeplex, and he also blogs at Los Techies. Him and I are starting a community called Community for MVC, which is a way for allowing the community to contribute back to not the MVC framework, but the tooling that we might see that it may not be there out of the box. A good example of that is the first thing we pushed out there we called it a minimal template for MVC. So if you install MVC straight out of the box, you can go file, new web, and then you select MVC project. They give you all this stuff, all these home controllers, the admin controller, the views. That looks great for an F5 demo, but if you actually want to write a real application with it, you're going to have to sit there and take all that crap out. So what we did is we actually took that and trimmed it down and created a VSI template. So then you can download and then just go straight out of the box and say, hey, it's an empty controllers, empty models, empty views, and this is all you get. So we're kind of pushing to that sort of aspect of it. I'm working on an Azure MVC template, VSI template, and I think I was talking with Kevin about this through Twitter, just to make it easier, somebody to pick it up. So I can give you guys the URL so you can put it out there and try to get traffic out there and see if anybody who wants to join in the fun.
Sure.
Cool. That sounds like a great project.
Yeah, it's something that if you step back and you look at from, like, if you were to compare to the Rails community, we don't have a very good community around MVC, right? It's we have forums, we have blog posts, but they're kind of out there disparate rather than sort of one central hub for you to come to. Our goal is not to be the next agile web development, .com, but it's more of the, like, hey, you know, there's no point of reinventing the wheel.
Dude, development is all about reinventing wheels.
Yes.
If we weren't reinventing wheels, what would we do? The Smalltalk guys already did all this crap back in the 80s.
The wheel-making business is a good business.
Between Smalltalk and Lisp, there's no wheels left.
It's all a list.
I was going to say, we're all just building rims right now.
All right, do we have lightning round material?
I had five, and then I cut one because I realized it was kind of a duplicate. But maybe we could go with four.
Favorite JavaScript keyword.
You should. I'll
throw that one in.
Your lightning round should be
favorite JavaScript keyword.
Your lightning round should be brought to us courtesy of whatever MVC class that you're plugging.
I don't really plug stuff very well. I had to do
favorite
that one today
Samuel
under the
declarative thingy.
I had to do that one today under the influence of something. I don't know.
If you don't know what it was, you probably shouldn't be drinking it.
All right, so we're going to do this thing with the lightning round where I'll ask a question and we'll go around in order. So we'll go to, I guess we'll do Javier first, and then Scott Kuhn, and then Kevin, and then John Galloway will go last. And you only have about 10 seconds to come up with an answer.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Are you ready, Ski Daddy? All right. Question number one was that the ASP.NET MVC source code was released under the Microsoft permissive license this week. Is that good or bad, Javier?
That is awesome. It allows you to do more stuff with it. Is that my 10 seconds?
That's it. Scott Kuhn.
Damn it. Mute.
10 seconds over, Kevin Dente.
I think it's great, mostly because it means it'll be able to run on mono. I think that'll end up being the biggest benefit of it all.
All right, Scott Kuhn.
It's good because if nothing else, it shows that the so-called battleship inside of Redmond is turning.
John G.
Yep. In addition to the mono thing, I can copy and paste the source code into my app, which is nice.
More copy paste. Yay.
Big hammer.
All right, next question. Is ASP.NET web forms dead to you, Javier?
No, it is not. I still have lots of apps that I have to maintain with it.
Mr. Kuhn?
God, if I have any say in my future career path, it is.
Mr. Kevin?
Dead.
Mr. John?
I'm not sure. It's probably dead. Although, if I had to do some huge amount of forms, I don't know yet. It's probably dead. Or almost dead.
All right, so here's another question. If you look at applications like nerddinner.com, and I think the application that Rob's Subsonic MVC template produces, you'll see lots of magic strings in the views. So when someone's creating a text box with the HTML helpers, they'll say html.textbox, and they'll put the name as a string literal and maybe the property that they want to pull out as a string literal. And that's one school of thought. The other school of thought is to use things from MVC Contrib or the MVC Futures, I think, has this too, where you can have everything strongly typed. So you say html.textbox4 and then use a lambda expression to indicate a property on your model. So I'm wondering which way people prefer to go, with strings or with strong typing?
I'm all for strong typing and fluent interfaces. It reads well and hopefully makes it easier for you to get feedback at compile time.
The question is, magic strings, do you let magic strings into your view, or do you try to use lambda expressions or something magical so that you don't have to have string literals?
So we've tried to eliminate them at every possible junction. We've even written strongly typed resource wrappers, helper classes, so that as we localize, we don't have to put in the magic strings either. Interviews, and we've tried to eliminate them or pass them in as options to constructors in our JavaScript functions as well.
Strong typing for me, 100%. If you're gonna take on the shackles of a statically typed language, you damn well better get something in return. And to me, that's the compiler type checking. I'm not gonna give that up.
Yep. I love strong type stuff. Whenever possible, I think, find out your errors early, prevent spelling errors, all that stuff. So I'm a fan of it. Well, I agree with Kevin. While we're stuck in a strongly typed language, use it.
Question number 4. What is the ultimate UI platform? Is it the ASP.NET MVC framework, or is it Silverlight 3?
Those are the choices.
You're not going to put JavaScript in there.
The holodeck, obviously, duh.
The Surface, of course.
That's Microsoft Surface.
The Surface. Watch. You know, the poor Surface gets trotted out at like every conference. It's ridiculous.
It's like bringing out your autistic cousin because he got a trick. Look, you can drag pictures around. You can throw this little card on it. Get a little treat, maybe a T-shirt, if you go around to all 20 Surface tables. Dance, monkey, dance!
It's like the car manufacturer that always brings out the comp. They always have the concept car that you can never buy, and will never actually be useful to you in any way.
Right. It's the Tesla sports car.
See, what I want to see is how good those things are at a toddler, right? you give them a cup or something and let it go nuts on the Surface, and see if it actually is worth it.
So you guys are joking, but I mean, we're talking about the Java desktop system, right?
Yes. Looking Glass. Yes. There's your trivia for the night.
There really was no question. It broke down because I didn't research the lightning round properly.
What about the favorite JavaScript
But I was keyword? Curious. Yeah. So last question of the lightning round, which has been far too long for lightning, but that's all right. What is your favorite JavaScript keyword?
Wow, there's so many.
No, there aren't. That's the point.
I can't answer. I'm laughing too hard. I'm going to pass.
Can I just answer for everyone? I think it's the with keyword, right?
Sure.
Everyone loves the with keyword. I mean,
the best JavaScript keyword is call. Function.call. It is awesome. It's everything that C# wants to be when it grows up.
You have one, Kevin?
No.
I was going to say, Kevin, that JavaScript stuff is the thing that makes Gmail go.
My favorite JavaScript keyword is $.
For me, it was a toss-up between debugger and var. Just because I like to say var pirate style, I'll just sit at my... When I'm typing JavaScript code, I'll just go var.
I like var. Because I like to be able to copy my JavaScript code and paste it into my C# classes and just have it work.
While we're on that note, I just want to give a quick shout out to anyone that refers to JavaScript as Java, because I love you.
The only thing better than that is the people who chime in and say it's ECMAScript.
or standard 292.
Or there are certain demographics that will only refer to it as JScript, no matter how hard you probe them or prompt them. It is JScript.
I just use VBScript in the browser. I don't know what's this JavaScript stuff you're talking about.
Yes.
VBScript, baby.
Hey, I recently saw VBScript in a web page. Apparently, it was driving a pivot table, and it was easy to copy the VBA and paste it into the ASPX.
It's two kinds of awesome in one NuGet center, man.
Yeah.
Can you use VBScript to drive Silverlight? Have we tried? Well, I bet it's still in there. John?
I'm sure we could. I've got the Silverlight DLR. I think they said with the DLR that I'm not sure. I'll check into it. I'll report back next week.
You know why JavaScript kicks VBScript's ass? Just the simple case of var versus dim. var makes you sound like a pirate. Like, var! As opposed to dim. Dim.
Well, VB is kind of dim. Well, it's kind of appropriate.
So if they put in the DLR, if they do migrate VBScript to the CLR, will they have strongly typed variables and instead of dim, you'll type dumb?
All right. I think on that note,
have we degenerated enough?
Thanks a lot for coming on, Javier.
Oh, well, thank you, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Awesome.
We're signing out from this week's episode of Herding Code. Join us next week.